The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and on The Breakfast Grill today we have Professor Steven Pinker, a Canadian-American cognitive psychologist and the author of more than half a dozen popular books, including The Better Angels of Our Nature, History of Violence and Humanity. Based in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University, Professor Pinker's latest book is titled Enlightenment Now. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I want to begin with this major endorsement by Microsoft founder Bill Gates. He calls Enlightenment Now his favorite book of all time. Steve, can I ask you whether you wrote this book for the Bill Gates of the world? And if not, who did you write this book for?
Okay. I did not write it for the Bill Gates of this world, but I did it in recognition of the kind of effort that Bill Gates has made through his foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that if we apply science and reasoning to human problems, then we can gradually succeed. And the Gates Foundation has reduced the rate of infectious disease in much of the developing world. Some people credit the foundation with saving 100 million lives through the promotion of vaccination. And it's that kind of improvement in human welfare through reason and science that Gates endorses and Gates practices, and I endorse. I merely write books. He actually does it. But I wrote it not just for him, but also for people who are alienated by the current move toward authoritarianism and nationalism and tribalism and populism and religious fundamentalism, but have a trouble identifying and defending what they do believe in. Everyone knows what they're against, but what are they for? And I suggest that the ideals of the Enlightenment, of reason and science and humanism and progress, capture what people often believe but have trouble articulating, that we can make the world better, we can make humanity better by using an understanding of the world to reduce suffering and enhance human flourishing.
I wonder if we could go back a little ways into your own personal history as part of the source of some of these perspectives that you just articulated. You were born in Canada, I believe, and you, as a teenager, considered yourself an anarchist. But there were certain experiences you had that pushed you into science, away from anarchism, and to the kind of politics that you have. Was Canada, at the time that you were growing up, instrumental in terms of creating the kind of worldview that you now articulate?
Well, Canada is, in many ways, a kind of an embodiment of the Enlightenment values that I'm now promoting. And Canada, far more than the United States, is advancing the ideal that through international cooperation, through policy based on evidence, through a mixture of regulation and markets and freedom and democracy can make people healthier and happier and, in general, better off. That experience that you referred to was I was too young to be part of the 1960s campus protests. I was just a teenager. But there were ideas in the air like Marxism and anarchism and violent revolution that were kind of hip and chic and popular. And I was 14 years old, what did I know, and they sounded okay to me. And I argued with my parents, and they said, if the police ever disappeared, then all hell would break loose. There would be violence, there would be shootings. And I said, oh, no, don't be ridiculous. People are inherently good. They don't need police to behave. Well, as it happened, the Montreal police went on strike in 1969, and so my beliefs were put to a scientific test, and my parents were right, and I was wrong. Violence did break out. Two people were murdered. There was looting. There was rioting. As soon as the police were off duty, then some of the worst aspects of human nature broke out. So starting then and continuing now, I do believe that there is such a thing as human nature. I think that humans by themselves have a number of nasty traits like revenge, like dominance, like exploitation, and that we need the norms and institutions of a civilized society to keep the evil parts of human nature in check. On the other hand, I believe that human nature is very complex. It includes some of these destructive urges, but it also includes empathy and self-control and reason and moral norms. And that over the course of history and in different times and places, different parts of human nature can predominate. And our goal should be to create a set of an environmental condition in which the better parts of human nature predominate. That's why I titled my earlier book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, borrowing a phrase from Abraham Lincoln.
Coming back to your most recent book, Enlightenment Now, the word, the term enlightenment itself, this expectation of progress, of rationality, of reason, eclipsing older worldview dominated by religion and perhaps superstition and such, that itself was battered heavily in the 20th century. So when you use it, I guess now, you're not naive to the trouble that the Enlightenment project itself has encountered over the last century. How do you deal with that pushback that people will be pointing to various things that the 20th century demonstrated in terms of the darker side of human nature?
Well, absolutely. But those eruptions of the darker side of human nature came from counter-Enlightenment ideologies. That is, from people who fought back against the Enlightenment and argued that we are inherently tribal or national. We belong to a bloodline, to a plot of land, and that universal human flourishing, they argued, was a fantasy. So I don't believe that the Enlightenment really dominated in the world, or even in the West, until after World War II. Prior to that, the counter-Enlightenment was a major force, and we see it again today in the rise of populism in the United States and in Eastern Europe.
Of course, there are people who say that the Nazis, if we look at the Nazis as a quintessential dark force of the 20th century, they used science, they used reason, they used, at least on the face of it, the apparatus of modernity to push through their agenda, their, as you say, tribalist agenda. They're a curious paradox that modernization itself could be harnessed for the projects that are part of our primordial urges.
No, I disagree with that. First, for one thing, I do not think that the Nazis were reasonable. They did not use reason. They killed people who argued against them. That is a prime bit of evidence that they did not use reason, because the essence of reason is that no human being is infallible, that you can only approach the truth with free speech and open debate, because humans are flawed and reason exists independent of what a particular tribe believes. It was not reasonable to murder 6 million Jews, to begin a war that resulted in tens of millions of deaths. This was not reasonable. And in fact, they hated the Enlightenment. They argued that that universal human well-being was a myth, a fantasy. They actually rooted their symbolism in a kind of pagan tribal mythology that was rooted in a kind of primitive emotional solidarity with one's race and one's tribe. It was by no means reasonable.
Could you very quickly walk us through the elements of your book? You try to show through various indices, including everything from infectious diseases and murder, you try to demonstrate progress. Could you tell us why those issues are on your list?
Well, a lot of people, especially intellectuals and academics, argue that progress is a myth, that it's just a naive faith, it is unrealistic. So the center part of the book is showing that progress actually has occurred. This is not a naive faith, but if we agree that it's better to live than to die, it's better to be healthy than to be sick, it's better to be educated than to be ignorant, it's better to be safe than in danger, that peace is better than war, well, all of these things can be measured. And if you plot them over time, you see that every one of them has gone in the direction of progress. That is, there are fewer wars, there are fewer murders, there's less illiteracy, there's less disease, there are longer lives, there's more democracy. Now, this didn't have to be true. It's not a naive faith. you could only find out whether it's true or not by looking at the data. And so I present 75 graphs to show that when you plot the data objectively, we really have been getting better. Not in every way, that would be magic, but in almost every way.
I'm speaking to Professor Steven Pinker, a cognitive psychologist, linguist based in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University, author of Enlightenment Now. Next up, we look at the challenges to Professor Pinker's worldview. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning. If you just joined us, I'm Sharad Kutan, and my guest on The Breakfast Grill today is Steven Pinker, Professor of Cognitive Psychology at the Department of Psychology at Harvard University and author of Enlightenment Now. Steve, we ended with you outlining the graphs that you present in terms of education, in terms of peace, in terms of prosperity, declining infectious diseases, and also murder. Do you think that the charts of progress that you show would strike people as counterintuitive, that many people think that things have gotten worse, at least in terms of peace? If you think of the Syrian conflict or the refugee crisis in Europe, that comes to their mind first and foremost, and they would think, are we going in a spiral downwards?
Well, there are terrible things happening, and we do not live in a perfect world. We never will live in a perfect world, but one has to remember what previous decades were like, in which there were many wars that were as destructive as the Syrian civil war, all going on at the same time. There were civil wars in Africa, in Angola and Mozambique and Uganda. There were civil wars in Central America, in Nicaragua and Guatemala and Colombia. Prior to that, there were, of course, wars in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia. So yes, there are terrible things that are happening now, but there were even more terrible things that were happening in the past. And one of the reasons that I think people fail to appreciate progress is that as long as the number of terrible things happening in the world has not gone to zero, and it never will, they will always fill the news. The news always has plenty of negative things to report, and so our impression of the state of the world will be that nothing has changed, that things are as bad as ever. And that's because the news doesn't report the parts of the world that are at peace. One doesn't read about a story about Angola, which has not been at war for decades. And so the impression is out of touch with reality.
You're often accused of being overly optimistic, that you paint the picture of the good in humans more than you perhaps delve into the dark side of human beings, if you could use that language. Do you accept this criticism?
No, and I can prove that it's wrong. I wrote a book in 2002, it was just republished, called The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature, in which I, of all people, argue that there is such a thing as human nature. We are not blank slates, and that human nature includes many nasty traits. We are jealous, we strive for dominance, we are subject to illusions and biases. I, above all, am the most vocal advocate of the existence of human nature with all of its flaws and nasty traits. But I believe human nature is complex. We have nasty traits, but we also have good traits. What Abraham Lincoln called the better angels of our nature, and I use that as the title of my book. And the question is, in different times in history, which part of human nature predominates? And the positive trends that I present don't come from an optimistic worldview. They just come from looking at the facts. It's just a fact that today the average life expectancy across the world is 71 years. And not so long ago, it was 30 years. That's not an optimistic worldview. That's just the fact. It's also a fact that a few decades ago, the rate of death in war was 9 per 100,000 per year. Now it's 1.2 per 100,000 per year. Again, I'm not trying to put a positive spin on events. I'm just calling people's attention to data on how many people are actually harmed by war.
I want to turn our attention to the question of science and what some people see as its opposite, right? So the counterpoint, as it were, at least in the modern era, would be religion. Many people who theorize modernization thought that religions would disappear as we became more modern as people, or that scientific rationality dominated our thinking about the world. I understand that you are an atheist. Atheism is under attack. What's your sense of religion and its role in contemporary society?
I think one has to distinguish between religion as an institution, that is, as a community where people can get together, appreciate the beauty and tradition and symbolism of their culture, and religion as a set of factual beliefs, namely that there exists a God who listens to prayers, who intervenes in human affairs, who can violate the laws of physics, who makes good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. And I think one can enjoy the first part of religion without the second.
Because there is a conversation going on in the West, sometimes labeled the new atheism. Do you see yourself as part of that movement, the need to, in fact, battle religious ideologies or religious worldviews in order to bring people over, as it were, to the side of secularism or the side of scientific rationality?
Well, what I argue for is humanism. That is, that our moral values should be what makes people better off, what makes people live long, healthy, happy, stimulating lives. That's what morality consists of. And any kind of morality that differs from that, that says that we have to follow the commandments in holy texts, even if they result in deaths and in sickness, I think is immoral.
So I know that the devil can quote scripture. So I'm going to quote you in your book, Enlightenment Now. The quote goes, "Our greatest enemies are ultimately not our political adversaries, but entropy and evolution and, most of all, a shortfall of knowledge of how best to solve our problems." Do you think your approach to human issues largely lie in a belief in technology and science solving our problems as we go forward?
Yes, if we define our problems as what makes humans worse off, then yes, I think it's a shortfall of knowledge of how to make our lives as good as possible.
But what about the question, very quickly again, of ethics? Do you think sometimes the trade-offs can't be assessed simply in utilitarian terms, how many more people are better off as a result of this technology? Do you think there are questions of ethics that science cannot answer?
Well, yes, there are questions of ethics that science can't answer, but that's why we need moral philosophy, and that's why the ideal of humanism, namely morality, comes from what makes people better off, happier, healthier, having more stimulating and longer lives. That is not a scientific belief, that is a moral belief, but that's the moral belief that I think we can all agree on, because across all of our differences, whether you're born as a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew or a Buddhist, everyone agrees that it's better to be alive than dead. Everyone wants their children to grow up happy and healthy and educated. That is the common denominator that unites us as humans. And you're right, a moral question. That's not by itself a scientific question. But then we can use science to advance those goals, the moral goal of making people happier, healthier, and having longer and more educated and stimulating lives.
Steve, very quickly, what's your next book going to be?
Oh, my next book is going to be on common knowledge and civility, taboo, and outrage. How knowing what other people know about what you know affects our sense of what is decent and what we get outraged about.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking to Professor Steven Pinker, cognitive psychologist at the Department of Psychology at Harvard University and author of Enlightenment Now. I'm Sharad Kutin, and this has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.